Okay, good morning, everybody. Well, let me start here. I have a habit of buying books whenever I go to things like conventions and lectures, and they just sit on my shelf. And this one's been, I don't remember buying it. That's how old it is. But I love it. I picked it up for this. It's called The 5 Books of Miriam. Which in and of itself is a pretty clever title, but it is very user-friendly. I just think she does a great job of, she goes parsha by parsha, so it's a great, like, shul companion. And much like this class, she gives a wide variety of answers to some good questions, and in the voice of women, so I think it's a great book. So. Ellen Frankel, she is a PhD. Yeah, pass it around. Sure.
Thank you. I'm going to pass it
off. Frankel, I think. I just handed it off.
The reason I'm saying is Victor Frankel doesn't have an E in his last name. I thought maybe there was a relationship.
I don't know.
E-M or I-M?
She's done a bunch of other stuff. If you ever study My People's Prayer Book, she's also the feminist commentary for a couple of the volumes. She also did what I think is probably the best children's Torah I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah, it's illustrated and the pictures are great, and that's more what it's known for, but I think she does a great job of staying close to the text and making it relatable, not like 2-year-olds, but like 6, 7, 8-year-olds, that kind of age. Yeah. Oh, if you add all of those in order, 67. Yeah, okay. All of that was by way of introduction. We also are going to do something very different this week than I've been doing with all of you. Usually, I pick like a very small section of the Parsha and bring as many different sources to illuminate in different ways. This week's Parsha, I really think, has a very interesting narrative arc. It has a lot of individual pieces that don't necessarily fit together, and yet they're squished together. And I think the truth is, I'll be really honest with you. Last night, when I finished putting it together and I was reading it over, I felt very confident that I had a clear message I was going to leave you with. And this morning I went over it, and I don't know what I was thinking last night. So we're going to work on it together. I think, yes. No Diet Coke this morning. I'm trying water. We'll see how it goes. Mostly because it's going to be a long day, so I'm trying to pace myself. I'm glad that you've noticed. But what I want to do is, before we get out of the Bible, we're going to spend the most, if not all of our time, just in the Torah. And then I've brought a bunch of sources, if we have a chance, to delve into some of the individual pieces. But I really want to see this time, instead of looking at one small piece, how they fit together, to understand each piece individually, and then say, together, I think that they are telling us something about the nature of Moses' role specifically, in a small sense, and the nature of trying to live in a godly way in an ungodly world. I think at a core is the tension between all of these small stories, and I think we might be able to pull a couple of messages out. So I brought most of the Parsha, but we're not going to read even all of what I brought, but we'll begin. So the first chapter is about lighting the menorah and anointing the Levites. It's the last sort of steps before they finally set out. Remember right now where we are, to set us in context. Everything through Leviticus was just getting ready to leave Sinai, basically. Genesis was learning who we are. Exodus was leaving Egypt and getting to Sinai. Leviticus is at Sinai, building the tabernacle, setting up the priesthood, making the priests' clothes, anointing the priests. Now we're ready to light the candelabra that's part of the tabernacle. The Levites, not just the priests, are now anointed. We've counted everyone. We're ready to go. And we think, you know, in a week's time, give or take, we're in Israel. The 40 years hasn't happened yet. We think that that's the plan. We're going to leave Sinai, trek straight to Israel. Okay. Now, a good chunk of this chapter that I did not bring is the order in which they left. We know the order in which they camp. This is the order in which, how they march. You know, the Levites go in this order, and the Danites are here, and the Naphtalites are there, that kind of setup. But what I want to know is who leads them is our first question. So we'll start at verse 22 of chapter 9, the very front page, page 1. I know we never start on page 1, so that in and of itself should be pretty exciting. I think I'll read this week. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a year, however long the cloud lingered over the tabernacle, the Israelites remained in camp and did not set out. Only when it lifted did they break camp. On a sign from the Lord they made camp. On a sign from the Lord they broke camp. They observed the Lord's mandate at the Lord's bidding through Moses. Okay, so how do they know when they're going to leave? Okay, when the sun shines or when the cloud breaks, but maybe that's the same thing. Great. Or it's not entirely clear if this is like a way up cloud or if this is like some sort of fog engulfing the top of the tabernacle. But it seems we've got a guide, at least of when to leave and when not, and this divine guide. It tells us we have explicit sign from God through the tabernacle. The next section is lower down on the page, but I want to read it not yet. I'm going to go a little out of order and continue at verse 33. So they marched from the mountain of the Lord from Sinai, a distance of 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord traveled in front of them on that 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. And the Lord's cloud kept above them by day as they moved on from camp. So I just want to process that. That means that the tabernacle or the Ark seems to actually be somehow being carried or floating of its own accord. It's a little unclear, depending on how you want to read, how literally you want to take it, in front. And it's the tabernacle itself that is finding the best place for the Israelites to camp. So this is so far what we have is a divine scout, a divine guide, a divine person on the bus in Israel who talks too much on the microphone. If anyone's had that experience. On that.
I thought if they moved forward when the cloud disappeared and now the cloud is hanging over it.
So it seems, if you want to, so there are two answers to the question. The first is, that's right and this is contradictory. But the second is, it seems there is, so the tabernacle goes out front, and the cloud then hovers over the people, so they know they're still going the right way. But the tabernacle is out front, not necessarily under the cloud, guiding them to the best place to camp where there's some water and shelter and whatever else they need for their enormous giant camp. And then when they find the right place, the cloud moves back to the tabernacle, and they know they're in the right place. It seems that's what they're talking about. The tabernacle in the wilderness is definitely mobile because they have to take it with them everywhere they go. The question is whether or not it's carried by everyone or it floats of its own accord. And you can read the text either way, I think.
Does both? At least, isn't there a scene where somebody stumbles?
Right. So there is at least some scene where it's moved around by people. That's 100% correct. And I brought the next section, 35 through 36. You could all chant in Hebrew if you wanted. It's Vayhi ben Tsoa Haron, Vayomer Moshe, Kuma, Adonai, Vayafutso Evecha, Vayanusu Misanecha, Mi Panecha. This is, I just brought it because it's the language from our Torah service, and I thought it'd be interesting for you to see it. That's where it comes from. That's why we say it there. This is what Moses would say, and then the ark would lead the way, either by being carried or floating. So that's what we say when we open our ark, and the Torah leads our way, leads the processional. Now, hiding in between verse 29 through 31, which we'll read in 1 second, is something very different. So far, we've got a clear message that God is going to lead the way, show them exactly where to go, how to get there, when to leave, when to go, where they should stay. God self, with some sort of sign through the tabernacle. Now we get this little section. Moses said to Hobab, son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. If we have time, we'll spend some time on the name Hobab and Reuel and who this is, but for the sake of argument, we're going to say this is Jethro, the same guy with another name. Just seems like it's probably a reasonable read. The other possibility is it's actually his brother-in-law, that it's a son of Jethro, but at the very least, most of our tradition regards it as Jethro, and that's if we have some time, we'll go back and play around with what exactly, who exactly this Hobab guy is. But regardless, what's important is Moses is talking to him. So somehow this guy's in camp. We are setting out for the place for which the Lord has said, I will give it to you. Come with us and we will be generous with you, for the Lord has promised to be generous to Israel. Okay, what is Moses promising Hobab, first of all? How is the Lord promised to be generous with Israel? Land. This is, Moses is saying, you know, our spoils from this trek, this journey, these wars we're about to fight, is a new land, a new country that's our own. We'll give you a piece of it. Which is, if you, on itself, it's important to know, that's a pretty gutsy move. Moses is saying on his own, God is giving us this stuff, we'll give you a part of it. Moses is regifting, before even getting it, a piece of the land of Israel from God to Hobab. So that in and of itself is important to note. So that's how serious, or either it's how much he loves Hobab, or it's how much he needs Hobab. And we'll read the next verse. Come with us, and we. So I will not go, he replied to him, but will return to my native land. So Hobab says no, and Moses says back, please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness and can be our guide. So if you come with us, we will extend to you the same bounty that the Lord grants you. So in the midst of being told by God that God is going to show us the way, Moses looks out to Hobab, a non-Jew, his family, offers him part of the divine inheritance, which is Israel, in order that Hobab shows us the real way and where the best watering spots are. And in wonderful, great, divine Torah style, we don't know Hobab's answer. Hobab says no at first, and Moses presses on, and we have no idea what he says back. Yes.
Sorry,
Hobab was not Jewish. Well, if it's Jethro, there is a tradition that understands Jethro as having converted to Judaism. So that's up for debate. So maybe he's maybe Jewish, but we're relatively removed. It would also make sense if it's Jethro for a couple of reasons. First, if you remember back in the Parsha that bears Jethro's name, Jethro manages to find Moses in the wilderness, so it seems that Jethro knows the wilderness. Additionally, Moses relies on Jethro for other sort of logistical matters. Jethro's the one who sets up our court system and advises Moses on how to be. It's like good, you know, interfaith dialogue, basically. You run your church your way, and I run my synagogue my way, and oh, that's actually a good best practice of how to run an institution. So now maybe he's doing the same thing and asking Hobab to do that. Yes?
In Hebrew, is Hobab and Jethro anywhere similar?
No. So that's one of the debates. Not when we first meet Jethro, but who exactly Reuel might actually be another name for Jethro, which is what makes it even more confusing. It's hard to understand because also Reuel is a generic. It's like Papa.
Oh.
So who gets called Papa if it's father, father-in-law, or grandfather is also up for debate. And on top of all of that, Hobab means like beloved one or loved one. And so we're trying to figure out exactly what's going on here. If Hobab is also kind of a nickname for like a loved one, maybe Moses really just doesn't want to leave. You know, Jethro is probably one of the few people that Moses can just be a guy with. Like they can just be a person with. Like Jethro saw Moses at his absolute weakest and lowest moments and has been with him and has been really the only father figure Moses has ever had in his life. So you can imagine that also there is a desire to keep Moses around. So my question for you before we go on is, what do you all do with this? So now we've got God's going to lead the way, and Moses wants to hire Hobab to lead the way. What do you think is going on for Moses here as the leader? What's behind this ask?
It could be that he's flattering him to keep him with everyone. which implies that Moses doesn't have faith in God because he's asking somebody else to lead them.
Or he's a good manager who could assign things to other people.
Yeah, so excellent. I hadn't thought of the first thing you said, which is also interesting. Like, we do this all the time, that we have people that we want to feel good and honored, but we maybe don't actually need them, and so we give them honorary titles, degree, like things like that, to give them respect. So maybe there is something like that going on, that we, Moses just wants to take care of Hobab. Maybe Moses actually has a lack of faith, that Moses too hears all of the whining of the people of Israel, all of the marching, all of the whatever, and is like, especially, what is he really asking? He's not saying lead us to Israel, but on the way to Israel, find us the spot that's going to have water and food and all the stuff that we need. Find us the good campsites. And what are the people always complaining about? That there's not enough water and food and good campsites and all the things. So maybe Moses is just sick of it and is trying to cover his bets. Or maybe Moses is taking this notion, God's going to lead the way, and Moses says, okay, but we have to do our part too, and that there's an in-between, and like the logistics of actually making that happen means you get the guy who knows where the things are.
Yes.
Great. Those are a pretty good range of possibilities of what's going on here. We're going to get even a little more confusing. Okay. Chapter 11, the next page. Now we start going from place to place. The first couple of psukim, the people complain, and God burns several of them to death. Which is actually a fairly common, like, it's amazing actually how many plagues, we like gloss over those parts often, but basically from here on out, almost every parsha involves a couple of plagues, or one, two, or three of destroying people who complain. Now, let's see who exactly starts complaining. Verse 4. The riffraff in their midst felt a gluttonous craving, and then the Israelites wept and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish that we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Now our gullets are shriveled. There is nothing at all, nothing but this manna to look to. Okay, so pause there for a second. There's, I assume we're both wondering what the riffraff are. The phrase in Hebrew is erev rav, which could be a direct reference when Israel leaves Egypt. There's like a half a pasuk that says, and an erev rav went with them. So it could mean them, or it could be a generic term for the biggest whiners of the group got together. It's not entirely clear which one. Either way, they seem to convince everyone else, because the next half of the verse says, and then the Israelites wept and said, if only we had meat to eat. And like, that's pretty real. In our families, you know, you can imagine like the first Thanksgiving dinner where you don't have the one dish that everyone wants, everyone's happy, and then one guy is like, oh, if only we had the fourth kind of potatoes. And then everyone's like, actually, I kind of did want. Like, that feels real and normal. And what they're asking, so their complaint is, we only have manna. We only have manna. Yes, sorry.
In the movie.
I'm assuming Charlton Heston, yeah.
Where they left Egypt, they left with herds.
Yeah.
How did they not have meat to eat?
Right, and they're doing all kinds of sacrifices. So it seems that enough meat would be the question. It's a great it's actually a great point that I don't have a good answer for, except that in the any time manna is mentioned, there's an assumption that there's no other food source. So either it's like different sources or different conceptions of how things were, or they had herds, but it was very limited, and they used it primarily that's in the sacrificial cult, and it was a very rare treat as opposed to the norm. Let's see what Moses and God... So we're going to skip the next couple of verses, which explain what manna is, and I actually read something somewhere. They found what they think may be what is described in the Torah. There's like a thing that grows in the desert wilderness that when you crush it up, it becomes like cream of wheat, kind of a feel to it, and that maybe this is what they were referring to.
The other thing is spirulina, which is plant scum that's real high in protein. It's like chlorella. And when a waterbed goes dry, it would rest on the ground. could be reconstituted as a very healthy substitute.
Ooh, so excellent.
That's a theory.
Great. But either way, there is the man has already been described as something that fills you in other places. And now I'm blanking whether or not it's rabbinic or in the Torah itself, but I think it's actually rabbinic. But in the rabbinic mindset, it also tastes like whatever you want. So what exactly is going on here? Okay, now we skipped to verse 10. Yes, please.
So number 7 that you're skipping.
Yeah. So there's a whole list of sources. In fact, one of the sources that I don't remember if I brought or not talks about what would happen is the dew would form and the manna would like stick to the dew. So you'd wake up and it'd already be there. So, and also from heaven doesn't necessarily mean from the sky.
Yeah.
Like it's a gift from heaven could mean a gift from God.
What color is bdellium?
I don't know. Green. Why not? Here you go. Please. Okay. Now we're at verse 10. So we're on page 2 at verse 10. So Moses heard the people weeping, every clan apart, each person at the entrance of his tent. So notice also the escalation. First, it was the riffraff, the Erev Rav. Now the Israelites. Now every single clan, one by one, is coming to weep in front of his tent. Not the tent of the meeting, not the tent of the tabernacle. They've come to his home now to whine and kvetch. Yeah.
I immediately read it as each person at the entrance of his own tent.
Oh. So
the
other way to read this, and the Hebrew is always unclear when it comes to pronouns, is actually that each person has gone to the doorway of his own tent to complain. It's sort of sitting on his proverbial porch, bemoaning his lack of meat. Okay, I'll take that too. That's an interesting drash, or understanding. The Lord was very angry, and Moses was distressed. And Moses said to the Lord, why have you dealt ill with your servant, and why have I not enjoyed your favor, that you have laid the burden of all this people upon me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I bear them, that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries an infant, to the land that you have promised an oath to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give all this people, when they whine before me and say, give us meat to eat? I cannot carry all this people by myself, for it is too much for me. If you would deal thus with me, kill me rather, I beg you, and let me see no more of my wretchedness. So Moses breaks. Moses, the one who always stands up for the... Moses often, he starts the model that prophets from Moses onwards, one of their jobs is to stand in the breach. The people do wrong, God wants to kill them, and the prophet says, no, please don't kill them. It's one of the professional jobs of the prophet. And Moses here is like, what do you want me to do? Also, if you notice, this is what I found fascinating. Moses says, where am I supposed to get them meat? As if God has provided everything so far. Moses has provided no things. Moses has only done God's miracles to make it happen. And yet Moses still, and maybe this is the Moses that asks Hobab to come be the guide. How can we make this work? Just to be clear. Okay, now God's response gets really interesting. Because in this chapter, I brought the all of chapter 11, we really have two intertwined stories. We've got the story of the meat that we've been reading so far. We've got the story about Moses complaining about having to deal with the meat. And squished in, we've got a story about the nature of Moses' burden, prophecy, and two guides named Eldad and Medad. Which are like, sounds like, you know, Tweedledee and Tweedledum. But we'll get there. God's response to Moses. Gather for me 70 of Israel's elders, of whom you have experience as elders and officers of the people, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their place there with you. I will come down and speak with you there, and I will draw upon the spirit that is on you and put it upon them. They shall share the burden of the people with you, and you shall not bear it alone. and say to the, okay, so answer one. You clearly, like, you need a break, you need a day off, bring 70 other people and they share the physical burden of my prophecy with you. That somehow it is hard to be witness to God's words. Please pass one back. Thank you. There we go. Okay, switch. And say to the people, purify yourselves, for tomorrow you shall eat meat. For you have kept whining before the Lord and saying, if only we had meat to eat. Indeed, we were better off in Egypt. The Lord will give you meat and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, not two, not even 5 or 10 or 20, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you. For you have rejected the Lord who is among you by whining before him and saying, oh, why did we ever leave Egypt? Is like an it's actually a pretty good translation. A couple of the phrases are a little ambiguous, but like that's the tone that we're going for. And you can imagine, like, if you've got a hierarchy of three people, you know, a worker, a boss, and a boss's boss, and if the boss has to come to complain to the boss's boss about the workers, when that guy comes down on the workers, it's gonna be harsh, and it's gonna be annoyed at having to deal with it, and it's gonna be, you know, that you can, it feels like a human kind of story. So that's why I think these two get intertwined. But so Moses gets to go back and say, you're going to get your meat, but you're going to be sick of it. You're going to hate it. It's going to be too much meat for you. And on top of all of that, and Moses, you're going to get a break. You're going to get some people to bear the burden with you. Yes?
This is one place that we have an indication that God is above, because he says, I will come down.
100%, we often use language of up and down. My point, in fact, we might even say the manna comes down from heaven. And we might use that preposition, direction, preposition? Down from heaven, but you can just as easily always read any of that as a metaphor. Anytime we're talking about God or heavenly or something beyond what is natural, up and down can be higher spiritual and lower spiritual, or the world that is more than this world and this world. I think is a reasonable way to understand them. Yes.
I don't understand.
Good.
Why, if there was too much food that it gave them afterwards, why wasn't there enough before? Why did they have to whine and complain before they got enough food?
So the two ways of reading it. One is they had enough food. Manna was fine, but they were complaining about not enough variety. That in fact, one of the understandings that I brought in the packet later on says basically this: what's happening is the people are adjusting from slavery. That actually, as slaves, they may very well have eaten well. In fact, they might, in some ways, have been freer as slaves because they never had to provide for their own food. It would have been beneficial to give them food as the slave owners, because you need strong people. And they might have even had, it says in our Torah that while they were slaves, they reproduced rapidly. Slave owners wouldn't have cared about marriage, they wouldn't have cared about laws of sexual morality or any of those kinds of things. So in some ways, a slave society, at least one that seems to have been set up in Egypt, was relatively anarchical. Anarchical? Is that a word?
Good.
Like an anarchy. As long as they put in their hours afterwards, there were no rules. And now what's happening is they're having to work hard. They don't have access to quite everything. That God is helping them along the way, but they're figuring out what it means to be masters of your own domain, masters of your own things. That there is a burden, and God is annoyed that they're not realizing the cost benefit, that freedom is worth it. That's what God seems to me here to be complaining about. You people want to go keep talking about going. That's their first complaint. Every time things get bad, the first thing they say is, we should have just stayed in Egypt.
Because maybe
Don's raising his hand, so we can have credit for that.
It seems like this parallels human development. Children are forced to go to school. They're forced to go to high school. They don't want to go, but they have everything paid for by their parents. And they complain. They complain to their parents.
Yes.
It's kind of...
Yeah, it's very similar. Or the difference between working for someone and being self-employed. That when you, you know, when you work for someone, you put in your hours, you take your vacation days, and at the end of the day, you go home for the most part. No one anymore really goes home from work, but hypothetically. And when you work for yourself, you're never done, because anytime you're not working, it's money you're not making, it's business that's not happening, it's the it's always and all the time. And that's what they're changing from one to the next. Yes.
It might be jumping ahead a little bit. Is the weeping kind of special? Because I think in next week's Parsha, the people weep and they each go to their own clan and weep because they can't get into the promised land.
I'd have to look into it more carefully, but my gut says that weeping, that we have a dramatic ancestry and that they often go immediately to weeping, or weeping is a general term for kvetching. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but my gut answer is that's the case.
It's an emotional response among
exactly. Okay, we'll skip ahead a little more. And now we're going to get the story of Eldad and Medad. So God has now given Moses permission, bring 70 elders with you, and then they'll share the burden of my prophecy. That for whatever the reason, we're saying that God thinks Moses is burdened. The reason why he's cracked is that bearing the weight, Moses, it's interesting, complains about bearing the weight of the people, and God says, I'll lessen the weight of me. So either God is a really good counselor / therapist, and understands what Moses is saying behind the scenes, or God is a terrible boss and is not listening at all to what Moses is saying and doing something else. But either way, Moses takes God up on the offer. And let's find out what happens. Moses went out and reported the words of the Lord to the people. He gathered 70 of the people's elders and stationed them around the tent. Then the Lord came down in a cloud and spoke to him. He spoke upon the spirit that was on him and put it upon the 70 elders. And when the spirit rested upon them, they spoke in ecstasy, but did not continue. Okay. Let's try and understand this scene. 70 people, the tent of meeting as opposed to the tabernacle, assuming they actually are two different places, which is another conversation, is on the outskirts of the camp. It was sort of a special place where just Moses went to talk to God. It's complicated in the Moses-Aaron dichotomy and who gets what, but basically the tabernacle is Aaron's domain and the tent of meeting is Moses' domain. The tent of meeting is where Moses talks to God. This time Moses brings 70 people with him. God talks to Moses, and these 70 people speak in tongues, which is a common prophetic act in the ancient Near East. In fact, there were droves of prophecy. They feel like today's Hare Krishnas, actually. Like in similar fashion, like there was like a group of people who dressed kind of funny, who went around talking kind of funny and said it was divine, it was holiness, and that's what they did. They lived in ecstasy. And here God is sanctioning / doing that, and in many ways is showing Moses is special, because Moses hears God's voice all the time and never once talks in tongues or ecstasy. That Moses is able to stay calm and is able to bear it. And it goes on, and we get, this is like, these couple of verses, I think, are one of the most fascinating sub-stories in the Bible. Then two men, one named Eldad and the other named Medad, which, if in the Torah you get two names that rhyme with each other, that come up that you've never heard of before, you know something is going on here, because like they're trying to catch your attention, or these are really two of the same people, or whatever the case may be. They were supposed to be among the 70 elders, and they were stayed in camp. But the Spirit still rested upon them. They were among those recorded, but they had not gone out to the tent, and they spoke in ecstasy in the camp. A youth ran out and told Moses, saying, Eldad and Medad are acting the prophet in the camp. So far, this is supposed to only happen out with the tent of meeting. And Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' attendant from his youth, spoke up and said, my lord Moses, restrain them. Stop these two people from doing this craziness inside the camp. But Moses said to him, are you wrought up on my account? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord put his spirit upon them. Moses then re-entered the camp together with the elders of Israel. What exactly happened here, we're not entirely sure, but whatever we know Eldad and Medad definitely prophesied in ecstasy, speaking in tongues inside the camp. We know they were caught and were seen. We know Moses at the end says, oh, I wish everyone did that. That would be great. You finally got to see. There seems to be a desire to name these two as among the 70, but Moses had, it says a minute ago, that all 70 were there.
Yeah.
So were these two extra people, or were the from those 70, and Moses just didn't, you know, take a roll? He just assumed everyone was there. 70's a lot. It's easy to miss two people. I don't have a good answer for you. It's a very confusing story. And what's more, it goes to our continual question of what does Moses believe in God? What kind of faith does Moses have? And what's more, not just what kind of faith does Moses have, what kind of faith does Moses want the people to have? We go back to the tabernacle that goes out in front. Does Moses want Hobab to be quietly on the side so that people see this miraculous thing? Maybe this is like Moses the magician trying to make the show happen. This is our organ behind the ark. I mean, you all know it's there, but there is a certain sense that we want it to feel that Marcus's voice is so beautiful and so divine that it inspires music from unknown sources. Like that's the experience we're having. That's the end of this little prophesying story, and we don't know exactly what is the case.
Are those guys ever mentioned again?
Never mentioned again. And there is a great midrash. It's fascinating. So the end of this, how are we doing on time? We're doing okay. In a minute, Miriam and Aaron are going to call Moses out and say, we should be prophets too. Like, we are prophets too. We should have more of the share of leadership. We're going to get there in 1 minute. And one midrash says that what happened is, in this moment, Tzipora and Miriam are standing together watching Eldad and Medad prophesy. And Tzipora, Moses' wife, says to Miriam, oh, woe to their wives, implying that once someone prophesies, they stop sleeping with their spouses. That is a consequence. And that when Miriam and Aaron go talk to Moses, their objection is, you have stopped performing your marital duties with your wife. Which is like it's pretty hard to read this directly into the story, but that sort of conception of making sure your responsibilities are everywhere. And Moses does not come across pretty much ever as such a great father or husband. He's not a bad at courting Tzipora. That's about it. You know, he saves her life at the beginning. After that, there's not a lot you could argue that he does a great job as a husband or a father. In fact, he seems surprised when his kids show up. Yes.
So the concept of purity versus impurity,
yeah,
that if God were to call Moses and say, I need to talk to you, and Moses was impure because he was taking care of his family responsibilities, then there's a conflict there.
So there could be a conflict there that I hadn't thought of. That's a good point. In fact, the 70 elders are told to purify themselves before they come, so there could be something going on there. It's a good point. Okay, but let's go on. Let's find out about this meat that they get. This paragraph is also one of my favorites in the Bible. It's a great parsha. A wind from the Lord started up, which, just so you know, that's also what caused the sea to split. So a wind from the Lord, if people recognize what that is, that's a pretty big deal. Swept quail from the sea and strewed them over the camp. About a day's journey on this side, about a day's journey on that side, all around the camp, and some 2 cubits deep on the ground. Quail everywhere. It sounds like a plague. 4 feet high, day's journey all around, covered in quail. The people set to gathering quail all day that day and on night all the next day. Even he who gathered least had 10 homers. I don't know what a homer is, if it's a kind of quail or if it's a quantity of quail, but quite a lot is the point. And they spread them out all around the camp. The meat was still between their teeth, nor yet chewed, when the anger of the Lord blazed forth against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. The place was named Kibroth Hat'ava, because the people who had the craving were buried there. Why does this is, you have to be really a close reader. Why does God send a plague? Because the first one didn't work. There's a reason the quail sounds like a plague. It's meant to be a plague. God said, I'm going to give you so much quail that you're sick of it, that you don't want it. The people just keep eating. They're thrilled. He sends them more quail than any person could possibly eat, like, or be happy. It's like, and yet the phrase that they use here, the teeth, the meat is still in their teeth, means that they're eating so much of it that it's basically, they're slobbering it all about, and they're not slowing down. God tries to make them smoke the whole carton, as the case may be. And at the end, they're like, I'll have another. So God has to send a good old-fashioned regular plague of pestilence to punish them. It's like both like great drama and like, what is going on with the people? What do they believe in? What do they see? The question of this parsha for me, it's constantly, what is God's relationship with Moses and the people? What is this about? All right.
Like this is the beginning of that expression, be careful what you wish for.
Right. 100% in this case, but it's God. they were happy to get what they wished for. All right. One last piece. Now we go back to Moses much more specifically. When they were in Hatzerot, Miriam and Aaron spoke out against Moses because of the Cushite woman he married. He married a Cushite woman, they yell at him. So this is enormously problematic. It means one of many things, but Cushite usually refers to black-skinned women or dark-skinned women, and specifically from Ethiopia. And so there's like a million answers that this might actually be a different person from Tzipora is one, that perhaps when Moses was in Pharaoh's employ, as when he grew up in Pharaoh's house, that the Ethiopia and Egypt were at war, and possibly Moses took a wife, an Ethiopian wife, as part of that. It could mean, it seems that there is some evidence that Cushite could actually just mean unusually beautiful. That because Cushite, because dark, that kind of very dark skin would not have been prominent, perhaps, amongst Israeli people, that it's another term for unusual, different, out there, and probably positive. There's also the opposite, unusual, different, and not attractive. All of those are possible reads. At the very least, it seems clear that they are upset that she is not a Jewish woman. Or if you take the Midrash I said before, that Moses' problem is that he's not fulfilling his marital duties, then this becomes very different. And this becomes, he married a woman. He has to fulfill his obligations to her. And that's what he should be doing. Okay, but they go on. They said, has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? And this time, the Lord heard it. But both Aaron and Miriam are called prophets. Why is Moses getting all the credit, all the responsibility, all the head jobs? Now, Moses was a very humble man, more so than any other man on earth. Suddenly, the Lord called to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tent of meeting. So the three of them went out again to the tent of meeting. This is Moses' tent on the outside of camp. The Lord came down and a pillar of cloud stopped at the entrance of the tent and called out Aaron and Miriam. The two of them came forward and he said, hear these my words. When a prophet of the Lord arises among you, I make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream, not so with my servant Moses. He is trusted throughout my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, plainly and not in riddles. And he beholds the likeness of the Lord. And how then did you not shrink from speaking against my servant Moses? So pause there for a second. What's hypocritical here? I just noticed this now.
He says I speak not in riddles. That's all he does is speak in riddles.
So yes, that's all he does is speak in riddles, except right here. He says to you, Moses and Aaron, I never come down and speak directly to the two of you except right now, which is what I'm doing, and you can't get more unequivocal than what he's saying right now. Clear and explicit, Moses is my guy. And the other piece I wanted to point out is Moses gets called very humble. We're setting up a precedent for Korach, I think. Moses doesn't stand up for himself. Moses says, let's go talk to God. And in a couple of weeks, the same thing's going to happen. Korach is going to say, you, Moses, get out. You know, I'm going to lead the way. Basically, it's a response. They're in the desert. They just found out they're going to have to wander for 40 years. And Korach says, no, I'm not following you anymore. I don't want to wander for 40 years. I'm going to lead the way and we'll be better. And they put it before God, and God kills all the Korachites, basically. And here, too, God yells at Moses and at Aaron and Miriam. So we skip down to verse 9. Still incensed with them, the Lord departed, and the cloud withdrew from the tent. There was Miriam, stricken with snow-white scales. When Aaron turned toward Miriam, he saw that she was stricken with scales, and Aaron said to Moses, oh, my Lord, account not to us the sin which we committed in our folly. Let her not be as one dead who emerges from his mother's womb with half his flesh eaten away. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, oh, God, pray, heal her. So only Miriam gets an explicit punishment, which seems possible. There's arguments that Aaron gets punished too in a different way, but let's say that's the case. Or that the other argument is that the reason Aaron doesn't get punished is because Aaron's the one who's supposed to have to deal with leprosy. So Aaron has to not be punished in order that he himself can heal Miriam. But whatever, Miriam gets punished without Aaron. Moses prays on her behalf, despite the fact that they just took their case to God and the people and said, let's move on. But the Lord said to Moses, if her father spat in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her shut out of the camp for 7 days, and then let her be readmitted. And so Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not march on until Miriam was readmitted. After that, the people set out from Hatzerot and encamped in the wilderness of Paran. And this is the most beautiful, gorgeous two psukim of the entire Parsha, because it pulls the whole thing together. We already know we have two people who might be in charge of leading the wanderings of the Jewish people, Hobab and God. Either way, either of them are supposed to be the ones to tell us now it's time to move on, we need to get the next place, God's going to be the one. Miriam gets stricken and no one moves a muscle until she's ready to come back in, and her readmittance is cause for them to leave. This is like the reinstatement. It's a beautiful moment for Miriam, which Miriam really becomes the loved one of the people Israel. That they're not going to leave her behind, no matter what. Whether or not God's cloud is where it's meant to be, we're going to wait for Miriam to be able to join us back up. And so we're left at the end with still the question, who leads the people Israel? What is God's role in all of this? What is Moses' role in all of this? So since I mentioned this book and pushed it, let's read so I can give you a little taste from them. Yes, always. Yeah. Yes, she would have been left. Maybe she could have caught back up eventually, maybe not. It's unclear. But regardless, the people decide for sure we're going to wait for 7 days for Miriam to come back. Yes?
I think there's a midrash that they waited because Miriam waited to make sure Moses was safe when she left him in the water. So it was like paying back for her looking out for Moses, so they're looking out for her.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Yes?
Did Moses give up? Was he tired of everything? In other words?
So maybe that's one way to read Moses' reaction, and that's why Moses didn't fight back here, and that what was really going on here is from start, that's an interesting way. Start to finish, this could be read as a parsha about reinstating Moses' faith. That in the beginning, God says, I'm going to lead the way. Moses goes on the side to book Hobab. The people start complaining. Moses says, how am I going to get the meat? God provides the meat. And God lessens the load of prophesy. Aaron and Miriam come to object to Moses as leader. Then God directly, you know, intercedes on Moses' behalf and calls out Miriam and Aaron and says, you're wrong to do this. And then we end with Moses not whining to God, but praying to God. It's beautiful, actually. That might be my drash in Shabbat. Nice. See how it goes. That in the end, Moses' last words are of the Parsha are, please God, heal my sister. And that moment, his faith is restored, and he realizes that's where he should put them. And what's best, in like true, God says no. But at that moment, God says no and yes. Basically, God says, I won't heal her. But that's when you find out that God says she's going to come back in 7 days. And that's when the people wait after Moses prays, which is like very typical. Yes.
When Moses spoke those words to God.
Yeah.
Were they his words or Aaron's? Was he still speaking as though he had a twisted tongue, or did Aaron have to do the talking for him?
And to make it even more complex, I think Moses is speaking directly, but it's not the first thing. Moses' response to Miriam's sickness is not to pray. Moses prays after Aaron says, please, Moses, pray on behalf of our sister, basically. Like, we need to take care of her. So is he responding to Aaron or is he responding to Miriam? Maybe it doesn't necessarily matter, but
well,
that's the case.
I'm trying to help. Aaron is in the scene all the time.
Yeah.
We've been told when Moses confronted Pharaoh, Aaron had to be there to translate the words for him.
Yeah.
Moses was too shy and
stuttered. Yeah, so.
He seems to disappear in all this.
So the answer is, depending on how you feel about who wrote the Bible, the answer is either that it disappears or that we really have two threads. And if you read those plagues, the plague stories, really carefully, there are sometimes when Moses is the one speaking directly and Aaron maybe is there and maybe isn't, and sometimes when Aaron is the one doing the speaking on Moses' behalf.
You just said a phrase that's been troubling me the last half hour.
Great.
Who wrote the Bible? As I read what we've been talking about today, it almost reads like either free association or confusion or a dream. It doesn't sound linear. It doesn't sound rational. It's
right.
Contradictory line by line, word by word.
All right, so I'll give you my 4-minute spiel on who wrote the Bible. It's really its own class, but basically it seems to me you have two options in how to answer that question. There are clearly, exactly like you said, seams in the Bible, like visible seams where stories are repeated and told differently. The best example is creation. We get the 7 days of creation story, God is perfect, God created man, all was good, all was wonderful. End story, start new story in which God creates the world all over again. It's the Garden of Eden story. God creates people first and the world second. People is imperfect, God is suspicious. God has to ask questions like, where are you, Adam? As opposed to the first God that never asked the question, God just speaks and there is. What do you do with all that? So one answer is, God understood that God's writing a Torah not for one person, but a multitude of people. And so God specifically composed, put together the Torah in ways that would have access points for a number of different people and different stages of people's lives and different points and where they are. The other extreme is to say that what clearly happened is there was an ancient people that had a folklore about them, and there were probably different tribes of those people that had different versions of the same story, and as those people became united into one people, the leaders and the stories became combined into one slowly but surely until eventually one book was agreed on, which became the 5 books of Moses, and that was what happened. And if you want, in between those is that God, yes, the latter one is what happened, it developed over time, but God was behind the scenes sort of nudging the writing, composing, adapting of these stories together. Regardless, by the time of Ezra, which is about 500 or so CE, BCE, I said that backwards, 500 BCE, The 5 books of Moses are canonized, and the Jewish people decide that these stories are our story. This is our Torah. And you could do one of two things. You can either say that all that's changed is we've become much better literary critics, that we have gained the skill to see these seams, and before they wouldn't have been noticed necessarily. Or you can say that the people then saw the seams and either didn't care and it just made sense to them because they knew we were a group of people combined with different stories, or they saw them as one and they saw value of sticking them together, of seeing them together. I choose, for the most part, to end on that last note, that whoever wrote the Torah, however it came to be, it is clearly the foundation of who we are as a Jewish people, and really who we are as a Western people. Both, you know, all three major monotheistic religions, although Don's going to argue with me about Islam now, consider the Torah to be foundational in to their whatever. Another time. And because of that, these books are meaningful, important. And for us, the way we've looked at them for 2,000 years, these stories together, how they interrelate, how you pull them apart, make up who we are. They are the stories that we reinvest with new meaning each time we come back to them. It's why we read them again every year, because the text hasn't changed, but we have. And when we have changed, we see something new, something different. We see or are able to pull out different ideas, different thoughts, which help us take the next step of wherever we are. And I think that that ultimately is the question that matters most. Less of who wrote the Torah, but what do we do with it now that we have it? And to me, studying it, reading it, looking for the holes, the seams, and the gaps, and seeing how we have dealt with that over time, what are the answers, what are the possibilities? So hopefully that's mostly unsatisfactory to you, because it's a long and difficult tradition. And that's what, do you want to go for it?
I have a question unrelated to what you just said.
Yeah.
Did Miriam ever marry and have children?
Probably. We actually say that she probably married Caleb. It's one of the two who become the Joshua and Caleb are the two good spies, basically, from the first time around. The tradition has them as being married.
But we never found the ketubah.
We never found the ketubah. Okay, we'll conclude as we do. I'm sorry, I forgot to say the bracha at the beginning of this week, so I hope you'll find an opportunity later. We'll conclude with Kaddish to Rabbanan, the rabbi's Kaddish.